Announced in 1912, the Schneider Trophy was a series of glamorous air contests, popularly known as races, that captured both sides of the Atlantic. The new book called Wings Over Water explores this fascinating period of aviation history. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of Wings Over Water, Jonathan Glancy. Jonathan, good morning to you.
Good morning, Charles.
Good to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about, then, the idea behind an air race. What exactly was an air race, or is an air race?
What is an air race? Well, basically, of course, Charles, aeroplanes racing round and round a circuit. But what was interesting in those very early days of aviation, you might have seen, and your listeners might have seen or know that film, Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines.
Absolutely.
In the mid-60s. Remember that one with Terry Thomas and Robert Morley and all that lot, Sarah Miles, and these people, Tony Hancock, and you see these wonderful skeletal insect-like aeroplanes being flown very dangerously around the place. And in the film, as in reality, these aircraft, these contests were sponsored by the big newspapers at the time. The Daily Mail was a huge sponsor of them because there's two things, Charles. One, they generated huge excitement in the media. People were really keen on them, and so newspaper barons liked them. And they helped push on the development of aircraft. So air races were a way of testing the aircraft for engineers to be able to design them, get them better and better, but also to generate huge, and I mean huge, public excitement.
And I mean, literally, people obviously flocked to the nearest aerodrome to watch them take off. I mean, we're talking 1912. I mean, the air industry, if you like, is in its infancy, to put it mildly.
Infancy, a toddler. I mean, it's hard to believe. In 1903, you know, was the first human flight in a powered aircraft by the Wright brothers. And they flew, the first flight was 120 feet long at an average speed of 6.7 miles per hour. So how quickly, though, people got excited about flight. By the way, initially, the Wright brothers weren't believed in Europe, which is interesting for some of your listeners. The French, even 3 years after the Wright brothers had flown, said, it is not possible, you know, only the French will fly first. And they did actually say that in the newspapers. They had to apologize, eventually, because Orville Wright turned up in France and flew figures of eight in the sky above the horse racing circuit near Le Mans. And, of course, in front of a huge crowd. And we're talking about 250,000, 500,000 people. And they're staring up, and there's this American flying happily around the sky, about 50 foot above them at the time. And that spurs on the French. My God, you know, mon Dieu, we must fly. And that spurred on the Italians. Yeah, we must fly as well. And really, it became this extraordinary national effort to fly. But it all came into focus with this character, Jack Schneider. Schneider was the son of a very wealthy armaments and industrial production company in France. But he was a daredevil young man. And he thought, this is ever so exciting. But Charles, he had one other thing which is really important and why the Schneider Trophy matters in history. He had the idea, maybe aeroplanes should fly from the sea. So instead of you going to airports, as we do, actually we don't do today, do we, because of the virus. But yeah.
In theory, we go to airports.
In theory, Charles, in theory we go to airports, as we used to. And airports, think of the name, port, you know, a port's by the sea, but airports developed on the land for reasons we can talk about in a sec. But Jack Schneider wanted them to fly from airports, from the sea, because he said the big cities in the world, the big dynamic cities, Sydney, Barcelona, London, you know, keep going, you know, are by the sea, Barcelona, and that's true. So what if the aeroplanes could fly people and cargo from the great seaports? Wouldn't that be sensible? Yeah, what a great idea. It didn't quite happen, and that is the strange sadness of the story of the Schneider Trophy.
Mm. One of the things as well that perhaps, you know, a contemporary audience may find a little bit hard to appreciate is that thing about nationalism and patriotism. I mean your country.
Yes.
You see, I'm you know, my big thing is motor racing and between the wars, yeah, and even after the wars, you raced in your country's colours, and this was very much, you just mentioned, you know, France not believing that an American could go up in the air because, yeah, obviously we are the Montgolfier brothers, we are descendants.
Yeah, exactly.
So
exactly,
I mean,
that.
There's a tremendous amount of, you know, of healthy patriotism in the sport as well.
Oh, it's a really good point, Giles. You put your finger on something that's very important. So the Schneider Trophy started off the first contest or races in 1913 in Monaco. And although the teams had to be national teams, it was all done in a tremendous spirit of cooperation and internationalism. I mean, friendly rivalry, as you say, like amongst racing drivers, intense rivalry, of course, for the pilots, as for racing Formula One racing car drivers. But the teams themselves would actually share knowledge. They would share, at the time, they would share engines. For example, nearly all engines at the time were made in France. So the British used French engines. The Italians used French engines to begin with. So, you know, they talked to each other, they knew each other, and it was a bit like in your Formula One analogy. As you remember, in the 1960s, 70s, Formula One racing drivers, they were all pals together. They had intense rivalry on the track, but off the track, they were pals, really, weren't they, most of them?
Indeed.
Shared parties, enjoyed each other. It was like that. But what happened, and you know this reflects the politics of the 1920s going, especially into the 1930s, nationalism, which is different from patriotism, as you so rightly pointed out, reared its ugly head. And the teams got more and more competitive as, in a nationalistic way, as governments became interested. Mm. And that happened first, believe it or not, in Italy, when Il Duce Benito Mussolini had come to power. Yeah. And he loved the idea of aircraft and, you know, technological prowess, and so he was keen, and he pumped Italian government money into the Italian team, and they came up with fantastic aircraft, and it looked as if they would win this trophy. And by the way, this was truly prestigious. It's like the World Cup in football. The Schneider Trophy meant something, really did. Huge thing. Newspaper headlines around the world type of stuff.
And the other thing, of course, is that, I mean, when we go to write history, sometimes it can be very, if you're doing a specific history like you are with the Schneider Trophy, it can be very easy just to go down that particular path. But no history exists in a vacuum. History is influenced by what's going on around it. And one of the things that I love is the cover of your book. It's got this wonderful picture of a plane that we will come onto in a minute and what it morphed into. But also it reminds me of that post-war period, the 20s, you know, that flowering of the 20s, where you have these fabulous new technologies. You have the radio, you have the, you know, TV in infancy, and you have the, you know, the Art Deco movement, the jazz movement. There's that feeling, isn't there, of the new arts, and that front cover really brings it out.
Really, and what's so fascinating, Giles, is that, as you know, at that time, economies around the world were in a pretty rough state right through the 20s, and disastrous with the Wall Street crash in 29, which happens at the zenith of the Schneider Trophy contests. So, you know, what the public was looking for, especially in flight, was a kind of glorious escapism, which you can see in that glorious Art Deco poster art at the time, as you can see in the racing cars at the time, as you can see, of course, in the cinema at the time. And the Schneider Trophies, as they matured, say, from the mid-20s, were caught on newsreels. So you've got lots of news teams rushing out on boats to capture these aircraft in flight. And as you get to talkies, finally, at 1929, you can hear the contestants speak, which is very exciting.
Tell me a little bit about let's say two things here. Tell me, first of all, because you mentioned that this became a seaplane race, and there's something effortlessly glamorous about a seaplane, isn't there? Let's face it. And then you talk about the where these races were held. You said Monaco, you know, Venice, you know, the Lido at Venice. I mean, these are beautiful and stylish, and speak of, you know, that sort of, I know it's a little bit early, but it's a sort of jet set location, if you like, before the onset, before the adventure of the jet.
Yeah, this is the piston engine set. but you're absolutely right. It couldn't be more glamorous. And the exciting thing is, for the organisers of the event, is that they attracted people from right across the social spectrum. So although the events tend to be held in very smart places, I mean, Cowes in the Isle of Wight was very smart. Venice, as you said, Monaco, these are really glamorous resorts at the time, at their most fashionable then, in fact. But the railways offered cheap tickets, you know, for people to come long distances. So, you know, working-class families, lower-middle-class families would be coming to these contests. Long, long way to watch. And they came to watch for lots of reasons. And early on, they came to watch, I think, disasters, as people do, you know, like people that stand on the corners of racetracks hoping for a race car to come off. There was a lot of that in the early days. You probably remember from your school days, you'd see films of early aircraft that just used to fall to pieces as they tried to take off,
yeah,
or implode. You remember those? But people did come from a bit of that. They came because it was a big day out. And then, of course, they got hooked on it because trying to create the atmosphere of those days is quite hard because in the early days there were no films and no sound. But you've got to imagine that even by the mid-1920s, these aircraft were flying very fast indeed, and they were incredibly brightly coloured, and they were very noisy. And by the late 20s, the propellers, Charles, of the aircraft were, the tips of the propellers were breaking the sound barrier, not the aircraft itself. So you can imagine the sound. So they're flying along with these tiny aircraft, really pretty, like, you know, beautiful insects, like dragonflies, making incredible lot of noise, and also crashing and banging through the sky. And that, you can imagine, absolutely glorious spectacle.
And who were the, who were, you said, you know, for the first time you could actually hear the competitors, you know, in the talkies, quote unquote. Who were, yeah, you know, who were the Hamilton and the Verstappen, if you like, of their day of the air racing circuit then?
That's interesting. To begin with, they were amateur pilots. So a bit like, again, your Formula One race, Grand Prix, Formula One racing, they were amateurs. And so they tended to be on the, not necessarily wealthy young men. They were nearly all young men at the time, of course, men. But they were included young engineers who worked for the early aircraft companies. People like Harry Hawker, you know, of Hawker Aircraft, who worked for Harry Sopwith. You know, Sopwith. You know, these people were young, very young, by the way, remember, very young people setting up their own aircraft businesses in their 20s and just having a go. But when the public money comes in, the state money, what happened then was that the teams gradually transformed, become professional, and more than professional, the military took over. So the great British teams who went on to win the Schneider Trophy in 1931 for three events running, they were RAF pilots, and they were really, I mean, the best, you know, best pilots in Britain. They were test pilots. They were stunning aerobatic pilots. And there were young men, very young men, who took huge, huge risks. And they'd already been showing off, by the way, through the mid-20s in glorious air displays. The RAF at Hendon in England put on air displays which were truly magical events. Aircraft tumbling through the sky like falling leaves. Very, very brave, daring expert aerobatics, and those guys went on to win the race.
Mm. It's an interesting, yeah, because this is the other thing. I mean, like I said, if you make a mistake on a racetrack, then you'll have a spin, or you can put it in the scenery quite prettily, but not hurt yourself. If you make a mistake whilst the tips of your propellers are breaking the sound barrier, and you're in a very small plane, very low, yep, above the water or the ground or wherever you may be, case, there's not a lot of get out, is there?
Not a lot of get out. And remember also, as the aircraft got faster, the very last aircraft could fly, you know, at over 300 miles an hour, 350 miles an hour, and finally Britain created a world speed record of over 400 miles an hour in one of these aircraft for the Schneider Trophy. At that speed, they couldn't see ahead of them. I mean, there's no view ahead. There's just an enormous cowling for an enormous Rolls-Royce engine, a big propeller spinning around beyond the speed of sound in front of you. So you can imagine the noise, the sound, the sun glaring off the water below you also makes it very hard to judge your height. Sure, they had an instrument, altimeters and so on, but it's a lot of it was done by instinct as well as technique, and they were just stunning pilots. If they did hit the water, of course, they would probably die. And the absolutely fascinating thing is, no pilots died during any of the contests held between 1913 and 1921, although, Giles, many died in training and practice. Mm. So I think when they went out on the day, you can imagine what it's like. You're pumped up, psyched up, totally focused, and you're not going to screw up. In the early days, there's a lot of chance of not necessarily you screwing up, but the air screw screwing up, as it were, the engine of the aircraft would fail. Mm. They had tremendous problems with cooling these gigantic engines they started to put in the aircraft. And they were designed, by the way, those engines, a bit like your Formula One engines again. They were designed, in the end, just to compete one race. You know, that was it.
Yeah.
So there's last great Rolls-Royce engines, which were really exciting machines, or the big Italian Fiat engines. All they had to do in the end was run for 1 hour at top, you know, maximum revs. And that was it. If they finished the race and won, great, it's done. You know, and then the engine had to be completely rebuilt. But imagine the thrill of that.
Mm. You can imagine. I mean, a lot of people say, well, what a total waste of time. And people often say that, you know, with other sports.
Yeah,
but these things, you know, somewhat like the very, what is the very famous speech that that Meryl Streep gives in Devil Wears Prada, these things morph into something else. And especially Reginald Michelin's, the Supermarine seaplanes. And I remember that reading about this because I, you know, I inherited some picture books when I was a kid from the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. And these looked amazing. And of course, come the war, they had a direct DNA to Britain's most famous fighter.
They did. The Supermarine S5 and S6, S6B, these are the aircraft that won the Schneider Trophy for Britain in three events in 1927, 29 and 31. These did give aircraft designers, of course, particularly Reginald Mitchell, who created the Spitfire, designed these aircraft as a very young man. And what he learned was that to fly very fast and with great accuracy and precision, you needed superb streamlining, brilliant design wings, and a huge mother of an engine that would generate enough power. This is obviously pre-jets. You know, you need the biggest piston engine you can possibly get to generate masses of horsepower. And Mitchell learned masses. He learned from mistakes, from experimentation, and from his pilots, and from his fellow mechanics and engineers. And that gave him the inspiration to create a beautiful high-speed fighter aircraft, which, of course, the Spitfire 1936, that went on, thank God, to play key roles in protecting us all and our lives today.
It's, you know, it's a fascinating book, and it's, you know, I often feel, because you see these pictures of, you know, commercial seaplanes, you know, playing, you know, and they're pulling into these exotic locations, you know, and they're on the Nile, and they're, you know, they're pulling Deauville and all that sort of thing. It's a great snapshot, isn't it? I mean, what led to the end of the Schneider Trophy and of seaplanes in general? Was it perhaps just, you know, the outbreak of war and, you know, the gathering storm clouds over Europe?
Well, Charles, definitely the war, but beyond that, something happened at the end of the war, which is really interesting, is that take any country in Europe, but particularly Britain, because Britain became a kind of aircraft carrier for bomber bases. You know, British and American bombers covered masses, you know, of East Anglia and so on. That meant there were lots and lots of concrete airports. Concrete airports all over the place, all over Europe, Germany as well, of course, too. And as also huge experience at the end of the war with big four-engine long-distance bomber planes. Now, those bomber planes morphed into commercial airliners, and the airports, these big concrete airports, were for them. And it became a simple, you know, leap of imagination to turn those airports into civil airports and to turn the bombers into civil airliners. And that's what happened. The beautiful aircraft you're talking about, which I love too, the beautiful great flying boats, they were far more expensive to operate. There were certain conditions in the sea, you know, which stops them flying. But they were a much more glamorous way of flying. And funny enough, what I do think today, with today's technology, is that they would work again. But that's a big, big hope.
Mm, indeed. How did you get the information? Because I'm vaguely aware of this, because I've got anything with a motor in it gets me excited, basically. So I'm vaguely aware of that period of time and what happened. But you know, is there when you compile a book like Wings Over Water, where did you go? Where did you get the information from?
Well, the first thing you do, you trawl all the past existing books. And that's interesting itself, because there have been books about bits and pieces of the aircraft involved in the Schneider Trophy, so they're very useful, written by very good technical authors. But actually, stories of the big event itself and the bigger picture, they're very rare. The last one, I'm just picking out of my shelf now, which didn't really cover the politics in the way I try and do and the social side of it than economics more, was written in 1975. So, you know, that's already Well, it's 45 years
ago. I was going to say, it's always a shock, isn't it? You said 75, I think, oh, it's about 25 years
ago. Always a shock so that it could be, but it is. And then you think, okay, so I'll read all these books, and I'll look up every possible website, which, you know, is useful. Now, what am I missing now? I'm still missing stuff. So then you go to archives and museums, and they are terrific. The RAF Museum at Hendon is fantastic, the Imperial War Museum, the wonderful Military History Museum in Rome is one of the best places, aircraft museum that I've ever been to. And you can see, and the races, by the way, the Italian blood-red Schneider trophies, kind of winged Ferraris, if you like, are sitting there, looking out for a great glass wall towards the lake in front of them where they were actually tested. And when you're there, you think, oh, can somebody just lift up this glass over this glass wall? You know, can we just fire these things up? Well, of course, you couldn't because they were, you know, anyway.
Yes, but I absolutely know what you mean, yeah.
But you know the feeling, yeah. And that feeling, you just want them to fly. But anyway, so in terms of research, so that's part of it. The other thing is that over the years, I've spoken to many interesting people involved in aviation, and including just at least two of the pilots who actually flew in those contests, which sounds impossible, but it's true, because James Doolittle, the great American Air Force general later on, and pilot, who was Schneider Trophy winner in the 1920s, when the Americans came on, just triumphed over everybody, trounced everybody, Jimmy Doolittle came to Duxford to give a talk, RAF Duxford, to give a talk with other Second World War pilots in about 1990. And so I was able to meet him and have a very long discussion with him. Isn't that incredible, really?
Wow, yeah.
Amazing to me that, you know, I could have that connection to this man who went on to become, you know, one of the greatest Air Force generals in history, an incredibly brave pilot. And he gave me masses of, you know, great stories about those times. And he was 90, but spoke like a 25-year-old, you know.
Yeah, yes.
Still, and that was the thing. What so excites me about the story, Charles, it's just that youthful energy that runs right through it. You know, that optimism. You mentioned that period, you know, people were optimistic about technology, optimistic about, you know, where we could go, things we could do. There wasn't that cynicism or pessimism. Today we question aircraft every which way, quite rightly in some ways, you know, about in terms of environmental destruction and so on. But people didn't have that then. It was just this lovely sense of adventure.
The book is called Wings Over. Okay, just think of it, because obviously after the Second World War, the jets arrived, and you can't have a jet air race, can you, really? It's not quite the same. Go on, then.
There are jets that fly from water, very few of them. Actually, the best ones are Russian, and they use them for firefighting, for example.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. I've watched one of these aircraft in action. They're in production at the moment. They're the best of Russian engineering. These things can, as they take off, they can scoop up water into their tanks and then fly off, put out fires, and land again. They used, absolutely brilliant. So there is a role still for planes that take off and land from water, apart from, you know, sports planes and leisure planes. But there is a role for them, and I hope there's a future, a long-term future for them too.
Absolutely. The book is called Wings Over Water, the story of the world's greatest air race and the birth of the Spitfire. It's by Jonathan Glancy. Jonathan, if people want to find more information about you, because you've done this sort of thing before, where can they find you on the social media and the internet thingy?
I don't do too much of that, but if you look up on Amazon Books,
yeah,
you'll see all the books, and that's the best way to find them, and then you can see, oh yeah, he's written about other aircraft too, Concorde, Spitfire.
Yeah, the small ones, indeed. And also, the book will be available as a download as well from the TRE Virtual Bookshop. This book is called Wings Over Water. It's by Jonathan Glancy. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time today.
Charles, thank you very much indeed.